This is the European edition of Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show. We bring you the European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders innovating the rapidly evolving fintech scene today. A truly localized podcast with both English and local language content with some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in the fintech sector globally. Join us every week as we explore what makes the European Union a phenomenal proving ground for many of the fastest growing fintech plays in the world today. Okay, let's roll.
Welcome everybody to Breaking Banks Europe, episode 55, that is dedicated to edutech. Now, I've been working a lot on digital innovation for the last 10 years, I would say, and I remember where I spent time discussing with the board of banks about digital. Basically, they needed to learn what digital is. But I think that there is another perspective that we want to bring on the table today. That means that we can also use digital to learn and basically find in digital a medium that enables to reduce the distances between people and knowledge. So knowledge is accessible, can be used, and can be an engine to create a more inclusive society and enable people to move forward with their ideas, whether they are personal problems, individual interest, or business issues related to their startup initiative. They are all related to the access of information and the proper communication of that knowledge. The digitization of knowledge has been, for a few years, the title of my main fintech keynote, as I do believe that it is so important in order to allow people to consume financial services to give them proper education, a proper understanding of the financial issue. Now, that is not just about banking, it's not just about finance, it's about any field of science, technology, and entrepreneurship. What I want to do today is also to touch upon some topics which are also related to the issue of human development and the making of a more inclusive society. And I think it's relevant for these days as we're all facing a second wave of the COVID-19. During the first lockdown here in Germany, I bought this book, which is a French book by an author called Delphine Minouri. And the title is Les Passeurs de Livres de Daraya, in Bibliothèque Secrète en Syrie. Basically, it's the story of a secret library that was created by the besieged people, the young people in Daraya, which is a city in Syria. And during the bombing and the siege, people wanted to access information, knowledge about philosophy, history, politics, economics, in order to open their minds, keep on thinking, basically finding a way out of a complex situation. Now, if I'm not mistaken, there are countries, I think France is one of those, where during the lockdown, books could not be sold. Not that they did not allow books to be sold, but as people could not go to stores and could only buy from Amazon, I think that in some countries, books were not considered essential goods. And therefore, as Amazon could only deliver essential goods, they will not be part of the online catalog. And that, to me, is very concerning because you're locked down, you are spending long hours by yourself. Maybe you need to make sure, you know, your travel is actually an opportunity also to learn and to invest into education as your timeline is very different. And that is something that we want to discuss today also. So therefore, using digital to access information where it is not otherwise available because it is not there, not accessible, or is too expensive, using digital in order to allow entrepreneurs to reach out to the relevant information as they might not all live in London or in prime cities like Frankfurt or New York, where there's a lot of people available for mentoring and for sharing info. Or it can be used for broader perspectives, like enabling people to transform their curriculum, learn new skills, in essence, having an impact on the broader economy. As we all know that these days, we face the problem of reskilling, which goes on all the ladders of society, from those which are entering society and the workforce today, as well as those that have been working for a while, but due to the digital shift and the change in the economy, need somehow to learn new things to be ready to embrace new opportunities. So we have three relevant guests today that work for three different startups. I will give you a brief intro about them, but then we have three different conversations so that we can basically drill into their stories and their experience. We will start with Jessica White. She works for Eduvation. That is a company startup that takes care of professional education, and she's a senior consultant for Eduvation. Eduvation, you may know, is a startup that was founded in Germany, but has an international reach out. Then after the break, we will continue with Matthew Johnson, and he is the VP Content Acquisition and Strategy Leader for Perlego. Perlego is basically an online ebook store that enables you to access the key content you need, whether it is business content or academic content. And we will conclude with Apa Pojavirta. He is the founder of Funzi, that is a fintech in Finland. You see that Ate is sitting in the dark. I guess that in Finland, in Helsinki, is already dark this afternoon here in Frankfurt. But he will enlighten us with a conversation about how to use digital to make impact on the society with better education. So let's start with Jessica Kennedy White. Jessica, welcome on Breaking Banks Europe, episode 55.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jessica, where are you based?
I'm based in Munich right now. So it's also quite dark here, as you can see. But yeah, as you can probably hear, I'm British, but I'm based in Munich.
Exactly. As you can probably hear, I'm Italian. I'm based in Frankfurt.
Yes, so we're very both, international.
Both host by this exact country. Yeah. Now, Jessica, just to learn a bit about yourself, because I know that you have very interesting experiences related to education, technology, but also the problem of disadvantaged individuals. I mentioned before Syria, there's a lot of refugees coming from Syria. I believe that before we get into the fintech topic, you launched a charity in Austria some years back, especially dedicated to the problem of lifting up the knowledge of people to be included into societies as they move across borders.
Yes. So this charity was called Think, which stands for Thinking Differently and Interculturally. And it was based on the premise of the situation that I saw in Austria at the time, as well as what I studied. I studied anthropology with my thesis actually focusing on integration and segregation of refugees, but also second-generation migrants in Paris, actually. And I saw that this is not just a Parisian problem, or not just a problem that is also in the UK, but also it's everywhere. And whilst I was studying in Austria, then I saw that the way to solve this was through education. So I designed programs for second-generation migrants and also refugees that were coming from all over. So firstly, the Balkans, because of the former Yugoslavian war. And then secondly, because of a lot of refugees coming from Afghanistan. It was actually before the Syrian crisis, so Nigeria as well. And all over Vietnam as well. So there was quite a diverse refugee group, as well as second generation migrants. And what I saw is that a way to integrate a large group of students into the education system was actually by providing them with the same opportunities that perhaps those more affluent students already had access to. This means, as you mentioned, libraries, access to literature, access to storytelling, not only from the host country in which they had landed within Austria, but also within their reactivating their own culture. So, for example, from Afghanistan, then we helped you uncover Persian myths and legends and songs, which really helped them to flourish and feel that they had a connection with their homeland in the host country that they were in, and then also undertake programs that were to do mainly with arts and technology, but then we integrated those into the school as well. And the great success was to see students now integrated going to university. Those girls that I taught in Vienna, they went to university and were the first in their school to go to university. And also people to get scholarships, to start families. So it's taking the long-term view, but eventually then people were able to find their way.
Yeah, very interesting. In the second half of the show, we will discuss this a bit more with Matthew Jones, as Perlego enables people that don't have big resources to access information that is otherwise expensive. So now, you started with this very interesting perspective. You landed into an edutech company that is Eduvation, that helps other edutech companies, basically,
yes,
to be successful in their field, right? So you had like the JD for all of these edutech para ones. So tell us a bit about Eduvation and then your role there.
Yes, certainly. So Eduvation is a GmbH that's founded by people who've all started their own startups, had the kind of experience of going on the roller coaster ride of ups and downs and raising funding and exits themselves, and thought, okay, there is not anyone doing this in Germany, so why don't we do it and help others through some of the lessons that we've learned? And we all come from different areas of education, but nevertheless have had our own startups. And Eduvation is, well, it's before COVID started doing a lot of the main events with Didacta, Frankfurt Book Fair, and BET in London, for example. Now we're doing more on the consultancy side, and which is what we were doing alongside the events. And so although we're still doing meetups within each of the regions, and so the consultancy is mainly around, well, quite diverse topics. So it depends on the needs of the startups. And those could be anything from trying to find funding for the next 2 years, whether that be investors, seed investors, or if they want foundation funding. Or it is simple things like market entry within Germany, but also the rest of the DACH region. I'm specifically looking after international relations, which means those startups that are international who want to come to the DACH region, or going the other way around, those startups in DACH who want to explore in Asia or explore further afield in America or perhaps in the UK. But then also one of the main parts that I focus on is product. Having designed quite a few curricula in Austria with my charity, and also being a former teacher, then it's really something that I'm passionate about, is to understand what are the needs of the platform or the app or the programs in which startups are trying to do and trying to run, and see how we can improve those.
Do you focus on edutech specifically or on broader topics around fintech?
Yeah, so we focus predominantly on edutech. So there are professional startups, such as there have been, for example, those who wanted to do financial literacy, particularly for children or for teenagers. There are opportunities or people that have contacted us with regards to professional education, but our main focus is on edutech, yeah.
So do you think the request from your audience changed before and after the pandemic outbreak?
I think that there has been certainly a lot more diversity since the pandemic broke out. Whereas before then, the majority of our team were focused on K-12, although I had enterprise experience as well. I think now I've seen a lot more coming from the enterprise sector, coming from the vocational sector, wanting to look at larger entry positions, but also looking on a global scale as well. So I think I've seen a lot more from the professional field since the pandemic broke out.
So do you think there is a market worldwide which is more advanced than others? And how do you think Europe fits in this international landscape?
Well, I mean, London is the perfect place for fintech. As you know, Frankfurt is also now becoming probably more attractive due to Brexit, unfortunately, for us, unfortunate for you. But certainly, I think that in terms of fintech, then Europe has, well, if we want to include London, has certainly been a leading player. But obviously there are, you know, Asia, I've spent quite a long time looking at different aspects in Asia. And I think, you know, Hong Kong used to be a great base for fintech. It's very difficult now because of the political situation. So, I mean, it shifts, doesn't it? I mean, just like capital shifts, finance shifts, fintech shifts. In terms of, if we're talking about edtech specifically, then I would say that Europe is a strong player. Obviously, there are a lot of difficulties with Germany because of the law takes a little bit longer to overcome because of very complex political reasons. But obviously now during the pandemic, then things have started to change. So I'm happy to take the longer view that things are improving in Germany in terms of how we can welcome in digital platforms. But of course, it's a very political issue as well.
So a large part of our audience worldwide is made of entrepreneurs, people that want to become entrepreneurs, bankers that look at startup, venture capitalists. So, of course, to make it happen, you need to make mistakes. I built a startup myself, and in my curriculum, I said that is like my life professionally was like the journey of Dante Alighieri in the Divina Commedia, because I worked for a bank 15 years in risk management, so all the things. And then I went through the purgatory of fintech entrepreneurship, and you really have to suffer a lot to come out unscathed or improved. Then you can access heaven, like whatever the digital intelligence, where it is. But
lovely technology.
Yeah. So now you are a Virgilio for many of these companies that go through purgatory. Is there any story that you might want to share of innovation, of without naming and surname of a startup that you believe? I don't know. Sometimes we have assumptions, and the assumptions are not true. So, is there anything that you believe is relevant as a suggestion you want to share here on Breaking Banks Europe?
Sure. I think one of the major assumptions at the beginning of the pandemic was that we need to provide as many resources as possible. And I think that that was across the board for many of the startups that we were working with. And there was a huge excitement. It sounds a bit contradictory with such an awful event, but there was a lot of excitement about let's get our platforms out there. This is our time. But then many startups hit a wall, realizing that teachers as well as parents didn't want to be overwhelmed with these kinds of platforms and resources without first understanding what are the structural issues, how can these be integrated, do we need training, and all these structural issues that were already important previously were even more important. And so whilst there was a huge excitement in April and May, I think that in summer it started to tail off a little bit, thinking, goodness, there's so much more that we need to think about, which is actually speaking more openly with teachers, more openly with governments, how we can create the foundation and the base for these platforms to come through. And then, of course, there's the competition. Everybody wants a place in the areas that people need. And how do you sift through that whilst, you know, not creating kind of a monopoly? There's a lot of governments who then went and found one particular solution and then decided to take that, missing out on all the other diverse solutions. And I think it's really important moving forward that, first of all, startups recognize that it's about the structural issues, it's about the training that's most important rather than the technology itself. And secondly, that governments need to work more pluralistically with the many solutions that are out there rather than hooking onto one solution and then creating a monopoly around that.
Okay, that's well understood. So we need to educate ourselves about education. It's also important, right? And unfortunately, the COVID gives us an opportunity to think and discuss about that, and also to test at some point, because we have a chance of trying a different type of approaches and solutions, and learn the one from the other, because this is a topic that is important for everyone, has no borders, right? Yeah. So I hope that everybody lifts up the different constituencies with more and better education using also digital whenever it's possible. So Jessica, thanks for being with us. You can stay to the second part of Breaking Banks Europe, because I would want to call a little coffee break here. It's just for a few seconds, and then we continue the conversation. So we had Jessica White from Eduvation, and after the break, we will start with Matthew Johnson of Perlego and Abe Poyavirta of Funzi. Now, Matthew Johnson in particular, I want you to talk to and hear from, because I am an author, and he's certainly hosting all of my books in his Perlego platform to make my knowledge more accessible to everybody. So I'm calling a break. Stay online. We'll get back in a few seconds.
At timepledge.org, we are building the largest free coaching and advisory platform for entrepreneurs by providing mentorship opportunities based on pledge time. Our network of seasoned industry experts acting as coaches is working for free, pledging their valued time to the next generation of entrepreneurs who will change everything. Our portfolio of sessions goes over every skill an entrepreneur needs to successfully launch his or her startup, from how to pitch and behave with investors to how to best market your idea online, or even how to best manage your team. We have the perfect sessions with the perfect mentors. Want to learn how to become the best entrepreneur you can be, or mentor the next generation of entrepreneurs in Africa and Asia? Please visit timepledge.org and let's get you started.
Welcome back, everybody, to this episode 55 of Breaking Banks Europe, dedicated to EduTech. We had a very entertaining and enriching first half with Jessica Kennedy White of Eduvation. And I want now to move forward in our conversation with our second guest, Matthew Jones. He's the VP for Content and Strategy at Perlego. And it's an important conversation for me, because I am a book author on a variety of topics. I'm sure that is hosting my literature on Perlego to make it more available and accessible to many around the world. Matthew, welcome on Breaking Banks Europe.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
So, Michael, first of all, tell me a bit about yourself. And then you will tell me how you help me to distribute my content.
Yeah, I'll go have a closer look at those now. Now I know how many there are. I've got a similar kind of background to Jessica. Actually, I'm a former teacher. I taught for 5 years, and then kind of moved away from teaching for a little while and into a more commercial role in publishing, and then kind of found those two worlds colliding with edtech and publishing, and was scouted in the really early days to set up Perlego with a co-founding team, and that was back in 2016. And so since then, we've been building up the business for the last 4 years, and we're now at a point where we just about to raise our Series B round, and I think in a really good place post-COVID.
So I have three different publishers of my literature, and I'm not going to name them because I'm complicated a bit. My first book is priced at something like $250, the copy, which I find outrageous. But that's a strategy of my publisher. And I know that there was also a copy that made available on a Russian website for piracy. Now, what I care really is the fact that the time I spent to think and write is accessible to people, because I'm doing it for that, right? It's not about money. So isn't this the problem that you want to solve? So make sure that people can access information that otherwise is too expensive?
Yeah, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there. You know, 250, I don't think anyone believes 250 is a fair price. All due respect here, but no one believes $250 or even pounds is a fair price for a book, right? And so, you've seen over the last 30 years, there's been a rate of inflation of book prices to the tune of 847%, which is three times the rate of inflation, which is madness, right? And this is a really well-trodden path that the people are now, I think, quite aware of, that increase in textbook prices. But I think what people are less aware of is that that's obviously led to this absolutely rampant situation with piracy. And as a result, you're now seeing a lot of situations like you pointed to there, that people are just saying that, you know, actually the books that I want, I'm priced out of the market. You know, that they are unaffordable. The models of access to them are inflexible, i.e. I may only need a chapter of that book. So then I'm making the value proposition in my head. Do I buy that entire book, as is the only option available to me legally, for $250, or, you know, do I get it illegally, or do I get it secondhand? Any of which way, you know, the author is not benefiting, the publisher is not benefiting, and of course then you end up in this spiral of decline, right? Because they're selling fewer books and they feel the need to increase the price to keep revenues high for shareholders, and that's kind of where publishing has got to on the academic side now. So we're in a position where, you know, piracy is now constituting around about 20, on average, 26% of publishers' revenues or potential revenues each year, right? And yet the publishing industry looks at this like it's some sort of, you know, problem that is totally insurmountable, right? It's this problem which they have a very fatalistic attitude towards. And the reality is that actually piracy, we think, can be solved by addressing the root causes of it. The root causes of it are that the consumer has a perception that there is a lack of affordability and that there is a lack of convenience. And if you think about it, any media that has managed to reduce piracy, and this is film, this is TV, this is music over the last 10 years, the only way they've managed to do that successfully is by doing it proactively. And by proactively, I mean it's addressing the root causes. It's making an affordable solution. It's making an accessible solution that is, in our words, making piracy futile, right? If we all used to pirate music, but we don't by and large anymore because we don't need to, because Spotify is there or Apple Music is there. We think we can do the same thing with books by creating Pelego, which is an ebook subscription service in much the same vein.
Okay, so that means you put yourself in between the publishers, the usual channels for selling books, and the readers on your side on topics which typically are academic topics or professional topics, right? It's not about general literature.
Yeah, and I think just to jump in there, we're not trying to suggest that everyone needs to buy books in this way. I don't think that's the case at all. I think there's actually, if you are to read the book cover to cover and you're going to get years of value out of it, or you have a sentimental attachment to it, or any of those reasons, you're still very likely to buy the print book. Actually, the print product is still good. But where we come in is, you know, what happens when you only need part of that book, or, you know, you don't know if you need that book, or, you know, and this is a really well-trodden path for students particularly, right? That's where we come in as a complementary sales channel, one that's looking to actually monetize the parts of the market for publishers that are traditionally just lost.
Okay. And how is it going so far? So how many books do you have on catalog?
So you've actually just 2 weeks ago passed over the 500,000 books mark. And you know, I think the important thing to realize here is that at the start of 2020, so 3 years into this 4-year project so far, we were at 210,000. So over this year alone, I think we've seen a real wholesale shift in attitudes of publishers, and much more are now open to the concept of subscription, whereas 4 years ago, I don't mind admitting that it was a concept that they were very unsure of.
So let's say that you are in essence, a platform that builds a matchmaking around the publishers or owners of formalized content and those that want to consume pieces of that formalized content so that they get exactly the value that they're willing to pay for. Now, these consumers, as in any platform, can become themselves producers of information. Do you only work with established publishers, or you also allow individual and independent authors to contribute to their material on your platform?
So right now, we only actually work with established publishers. And the reason for that is that we need to make sure that what we are hosting on the platform is validated content. You know, and I think that's a really key aspect of this is, you know, we are there for the content that is, you know, on reading lists, is validated, people can trust, you know, and that's not to say that content doesn't exist in the world of self-publishing.
But it's an element of curation. Yes, exactly. Curation is important, right?
So. But as a startup with 50 people, how do you attach the resources to be able to do that curation work that is obviously covered by the publishers? So it makes sense initially to focus on published content from you know, the likes of Pearson and Wiley of this world. You know, we have 3,000 publishers on board. In the long run, yeah, of course, the platform is perfectly well suited to working with authors independently. Obviously, what you don't want to do is alienate all of those brilliant stakeholders that we have on board with the publishers, right? And yeah, that's obviously a very delicate balance for
so let's say the publishers are global, the readers are local. So do you feel there is a difference in terms of behavior from people to access Perlego, maybe in some countries more than others? I guess you have no borders, right? So it's Europe or the US or Asia?
We're available worldwide. Obviously, not every one of our books is available worldwide. I suppose a bit like Netflix, you know, there are territorial restrictions set in the sales rights from those publishers. But 95% of the books we have, 95% of those 500,000 are worldwide. Yeah, in terms of reading and the way the books are used, actually, there are huge differences across countries, as you can imagine. I think those largely ring true with the type of formal education which is in place. So, for instance, in the States, you know, where there's less specialization in undergrad level till a later degree, you tend to see more breadth of usage. Whereas in the UK, you tend to see very focused usage from the start of the degree. Across the board, see a real difference between, you know, a year one undergraduate and a third year undergraduate. And even more so when you start looking at the postgrad market and who's using the platform. But fundamentally, I think what the platform exists to do is you have these publishers, and you suggested that those publishers are global. Well, often actually they're not, right? Because some are very small and don't necessarily have the logistical capability to find these new audiences in different territories worldwide. Of course, you know, with a platform like Perlego, you can, because there's obviously no additional cost to actually accessing an audience that might be for your content in, you know, Mozambique or wherever, right? And I think that's quite exciting to the smaller publishers too.
So there's many languages in Europe. So do Absolutely. You cover most of the European languages, or is it just in English?
Well, right now we're still building that up. So we cover right now English, German, Italian, and Spanish. But I think we're going to be adding to that very soon.
And do you think there is a difference inside Europe on how consumers would look at Perlego and this type of content for their education?
I mean, there are certain nuances in different markets in the sense that, you know, some are, you know, some have a different level of English involved in their formal education. Some have government mandates on who buys the textbooks. Is it the student or the university? But I suppose that's where we kind of cover all bases, because we don't only sell these books and individual licenses to the individual. You know, we're not just a B2C platform. That's our focus, yes, but we also sell to institutions. So we have in the region of 80 institutions, universities predominantly, but some corporations as well, the likes of Dyson, for instance, the engineering company, who buy licenses in bulk to essentially give to their employers or their students.
So I was wondering if you have a special experience or something that you have learned working for Perlego on your fintech experience, maybe something you thought and then you discovered it was different in the way people consume or.
Yeah, I think probably the main thing I've learned is that, in a business like this, that is, yeah, I think traditionally described as sort of a chicken and egg business, when you've got, you know, you're trying to get a critical mass of content, you're about breadth of content, but then what comes first? Is it the student, or is it the users, or is it the content itself? And I think that question was asked a lot at the start by investors, by advisors. The reality is, in hindsight, it's the content. You know, you need to somehow find a way to get that content on board first, which I think we've done a good job of, and then the users follow after that very seamlessly.
Okay, that's very interesting. So Matthew, thank you for being with us on Breaking Banks Europe today. I was very curious myself to see the way you are developing the business as a book author. And I think it's so important to make sure that the content that people need is available to them and affordable, because sometimes it's not, especially when we think about the broader topics like financial inclusion that comes from education as well. And we mentioned the topic with Jessica earlier on. So how do you allow people that cross the border, they are refugees, they are disadvantaged, to get a fair chance by just getting access to the education and the knowledge that comes with. And this brings us definitely into a conversation with Ape Poyavirta. Ape, welcome on Breaking Banks Europe. Now, Ape, you are the founder of a startup called Funzi, how do I pronounce it?
Funzi is the, it's actually Funzi. A word from Swahili language. It has to do with a learner and a group of learners.
Swahili language, actually, you're based in Finland, but you started working with emerging markets.
Yes.
At the very beginning of the Funzi experience. Now, if our audience would look at your website, they find a very enlightening and enriching catch-up line in the first page. It says that Funzi envisions a peaceful world where people are able to lead happy and healthy lives and have meaningful and sustainable livelihoods. But most of all, Funzi was funded because we wanted to use our unique knowledge in mobile business, education, and technology to have a global impact on how the world learns. So how can you make this impact?
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. So the company was founded in 2014 by us young startup guys, so seasoned mobile industry professionals who had, and by senior, I'm putting this into context, I invented the mobile app in 2003. So that's kind of, so we have seen the whole mobile industry.
It was a Motorola opening app like this?
No, it was a Symbian and Java app. It was about mobile media, but that's kind of so. But that was back then. So coming from an ecosystem where most of the basics of the mobile industry and mobile internet were actually developed and implemented, we had seen the revolution take place in lots of industries. Whole industry had been transformed. You look at music industry, you look at how games are played. The whole industries have been transformed. Not just changed, but they have been transformed. And somewhere in 2000, and I started working on it in 2009 and 2010, having a more systemic approach of, what is happening with the world and how do we start aim to reach these, fix the planet. It has since become sustainable development goals. And I understood, and we understood as a group, that we have to unlearn the bad things and learn new good things. And also looking at the world, we understood that none of this has, we here in the global north, for example, 5 million Finns, we don't have any impact on the planet. On a planetary scale, we need to focus on the mass of people, the 90% of the population of the planet who live somewhere and don't have access to learning and education. And we have to start with, yes, the curricula, the official curricula are good and education ministries are fine, but the traditional education industry is actually educating people into jobs that no longer exist. And as the world is going through this transformation period from post-industrial to completely digital, where, monetary systems and all of those will change radically, you have to look at simple things. And the simple things, so like the simple triangle of, is give people tools that allow them to have a better livelihood. That means a better job or become better entrepreneurs. And then using that same method of education, delivery of those skills, enable them to lead healthier lives. And that's, more money, more health, makes them automatically happier. And thus the company was founded, you know, we exist to give the planet a chance of actually reaching those goals, because there's no one else who is actually focused on that. Most of the people in the edtech or learntech industry are focused on, you know, let's make cash flow and let's make money.
Okay, so are you a B2C or a B2B? Or a B2B2C? So you work for others that want to use your solutions to provide better education to their communities, or you reach out to the communities yourself?
Obviously, you know, as we have this position, so we see ourselves as a transformative company. We see ourselves as a category changer. That's why we have had to validate everything we say. Yeah, that's why we have had to work for others. So we have, during the development phase of, you know, developing the pedagogy, developing the technology, we have worked on projects where others have defined what content is. Like Matthew, you know, wisely said, we as a startup, we need to have someone who guarantees the quality of the content. So using contents like that, and then working, for example, with UNDP in Syria. So, you know, when Syria was in shambles, we created a project with UNDP to teach people in Syria that we then measured scientifically. So while that project, yes, we got some money from UNDP, but the whole idea of the project was to validate and verify that using mobile learning, you actually empower change and can measure that science and validate that scientifically. So while we have worked in this project-based model, we have been developing a business-to-consumer perspective that we are now in the process of launching with a new release of our Funzi.mobi service, where we focus on creating a library that consists of free learning. And then, you know, we believe in a freemium business model where most of the learning on Funzi.mobi is for free. And then a certain part of the users, that is an estimate of 3% of the users, then purchase premium courses that add value to the lives of these individuals. And that's kind of because we believe that both must coexist. This is kind of the broad masses of the people need to be educated. They need to be given access to skills that they need for all of us to have a sustainable planet to live on, but it needs to be a business. And combining those using a intermediary platform is not sustainable.
So how does this learning work on digital? What people can read, people can watch videos, people can be part of games. What do you think works, but might not work?
During the thousands of years that we humans have been learning things in a kind of structured fashion, the basic concepts of pictures and text has worked really well, and that's what we rely on. Because in order to be able to deliver learning to everyone or to as many as we desire to be able to deliver, we need to use a robust technology. And robust, we define by, you know, who has access to that. And if we had a video-based pedagogy, billions of people could not access that. So that's why, you know, I love Coursera. Great, you know, Daphne, one of the founders, is a great, you know, we're not good friends, but we're pals. You know, I love the fact that there's stuff that works well for us. You know, I have an iPhone and I have I have bandwidth to spare. But then if we look at the people who actually hold the destiny of our planet in their hands, those are the people who are living somewhere where there is no bandwidth. They don't have money to spend on that bandwidth.
So is there anything that you have learned in your early days when you started the company and you approached the market out there? Just one thing that you want to share with our audience.
Yeah. One thing is we made tremendous success with in the UN kind of hemisphere. Great success with refugee situation in Europe, with our work in the refugee camps, refugee settlements in Africa and also in the Middle East.
So give us an example of a solution that you created for that.
For example, in Nakivale, refugee settlement in It's in Uganda. Nakivale is actually the world's oldest currently still existing refugee settlement. We have created a hub concept where we use the mobile learning to provide a global curriculum, and then we have a local implementation. So it's a blended learning mechanism that enables people to become entrepreneurs, because entrepreneurship is something that drives livelihood and develop positive development of livelihoods on a creates a social texture, creates, you know, economic activity. So that's what we've done. So wonderful thing. Could scale. The same applies to something. Everything that Funzi does is something that could scale to a billion users. Not a million, but a billion users easily. We just, you know, turn on the power. The thing is, what we learned is that in the world of today, decision-making happens by looking into the rearview mirror. So when you are creating projects, if you have actually entrepreneurial thinking in your projects, and I'm, you know, quoting on Simon's Nobel Prize winning thinking, you know, of human decision making, you have managerial thinking, and then you have entrepreneurial thinking. Managerial thinking is something where you in advance decide what are the outputs going to be, whereas entrepreneurial thinking is let's take what we have and make the best out of it. The official procurement mechanisms of the world do not allow for entrepreneurial thinking to be implemented. That is why Clayton Christensen's thinking of innovation always, transformative innovation always, disruptive innovation always happens at the fringe. And then when it gains, you know, momentum, it will just come and appear like a whirlwind out of nowhere. And I think that that applies for this industry like it has applied for many other industries.
So as an Italian, I hope you will find the time for a solution that teaches the world to make good coffee. That will be transformative and it's definitely needed. So yeah. I thank you for the conversation. I'm happy that we started talking about a book I read during the first wave of the COVID in my first lockdown here in Frankfurt. That is Le Passeur de Livre de Daria. That is a story of a secret library in Syria. We then discussed with Jessica White about innovation and the need of helping entrepreneurs in edutech to speed up. Very important, especially in the last year and necessarily certainly the next year, because edutech is growing. There is a growing demand that the social distancing is unfortunately imposing on us. So we can turn it into an opportunity. We talked to Matthew Jones of Perlego about how can content be available at convenient prices whenever, however, it is needed by the users. And we completed with Apa Pojavirta today, this 55th episode of Breaking Banks Europe, discussing Funzi, that is basically a platform that enables you to provide education on a variety of topics, especially those that have not the chance to access it, like refugees. And therefore, we concluded with a few stories about Uganda, about Syria. So I thank everybody for having stayed with us for this 55th episode of Breaking Banks Europe, which I remind you is the fintech podcast in Europe, for Europe, beyond Europe. And I invite you to follow us on our website and to subscribe so you receive the latest news and episodes. This is a wrap.
Thanks for listening to Breaking Banks Europe, a Provoke Media podcast in cooperation with FinTech Stage. Don't forget to tweet us out, shout out, or post to the team at Breaking Banks EU on Twitter. If there's something or someone you'd like to hear on our cast, let us know. See you next week on Breaking Banks Europe.